All right, once again, good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call to order the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And the first order of business is to take the roll. So, Ms. Niedernhofer, if you're able to do that, please.
Liebling.
Present.
Ewan.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer. Backer. Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Dameth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen. Grunhagen. Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Fryer.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. A quorum is present. We don't have minutes today to approve, so we're going to go right on and take up our first bill, which is House Bill 2108, Representative Long's bill. So since Representative Long's not on the committee, the chair will move that House Bill 2108 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Long, you have a DE1 amendment, and I assume you want to adopt that right away so you can talk about it in the form you want it.
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right. So we'll adopt that, and then we'll let you present it as amended. So members, if you would unmute yourselves, all in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Long, please present your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Chair Liebling, and thank you to the committee for hearing this bill today. We know that the building sector is 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions in the state, and we're not on track as a state to meet our greenhouse gas goals. So technologies that help us reduce the emissions from our building sector are a really critical piece of how we achieve our greenhouse gas goals as a state. One of those technologies is geothermal, which can dramatically reduce emissions for heating and for cooling a building, and often do so at a cost savings compared to other technologies. There's a lot of innovation happening in the geothermal space right now, and one new technology was developed at the University of Minnesota to transfer heat using a closed loop system that sits in groundwater. It's an exciting technology. You can see it installed, for example, at the Pipefitters Local 4555 in St. Paul. But with new technologies, we also need to make sure that our regulations are keeping pace. And there are rules in place that govern the installation of water supply wells, of environmental wells, and of geothermal devices. But there's no clear guidance on this technology, which is the installation of a geothermal device in a groundwater source. So variances have been required to date to be able to install this technology. And this bill would clarify that this new technology is a geothermal device that is allowed to use both water supply wells and environmental wells. And this will help all parties understand where the technology fits in the regulatory framework and to allow, I think, for this technology to be more widely used in Minnesota and provide the benefits of geothermal energy. And with that, I think I have two testifiers, Chair Liebling, if you would permit.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much, Representative Long. So I have on my list first Brian Larson. Mr. Larson, welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Long and committee members. For the record, I'm Brian Larson, CEO of Darcy Solutions, and Representative Long did a very nice job of introducing what we're seeking to accomplish. We are a new company spun out from technology that was developed at the University of Minnesota, and we bring a very exciting approach to provide sustainable heating and cooling to both commercial and residential building owners throughout Minnesota. These owners are finding it increasingly challenging to meet the ever-increasing energy efficiency requirements and sustainability goals that we're all hearing so much about. They have a very limited set of technology options that provide both the operationally efficient and cost-effective solutions that they're looking for, and that's where our technology comes in and helps them meet both of these requirements. What's interesting about our technology is that it spans two very distinct permitting arenas, water wells and geothermal heat exchangers. And because we don't fit nicely into one or the other of these categories, we're neither an apple nor an orange, and therefore we're left with the variance process that adds time, complexity, and uncertainty to each of our projects. So our goal is we're looking to deploy this technology as broadly and rapidly as we can to building owners and the communities at large to help them reach their efficiency goals. And we'd really like to find a way to streamline the permitting process to help make that happen. So with that, thank you again for your time and appreciate any questions or follow-up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Larson. And we have Bruce Clevin. Mr. Clevin, welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bruce Clevin, I represent Darcy Solutions. I first want to thank Representative Long for picking this issue up. I appreciate him, Chief, authoring this. And I want to thank your staff, Madam Chair. They worked with me on Saturday and over the weekend to get our DE3 together, Mr. McCollin and Ms. Clark was from our House Research. I do have to apologize. Mr. McCollin told us specifically not to have Bruce's iPad. He said, you got to have your name. And I changed my settings both in my Apple deal and in Zoom, and it's still showing up. There it is.
Oh, now it fixed just because you called it out. It fixed
itself. I don't know what happened. I didn't want him to think I was blowing him off. Anyway, yeah, so members to the DE, if I could just walk you through it. On page one, you'll see line 1.21. That is just specifically designed to say that a groundwater thermal exchange device can, in fact, go into the environmental well. As Mr. Larson mentioned, the chief goal we have here is clarity. It is not to skirt the rules. It's certainly not to contaminate the groundwater. It's to try to get a process for both Darcy and the department to move forward without the variances. Quickly, page two. Again, you'll see line 2.8 is similar. Number three, line 2.189 talks about the permits. And again, we're referencing the groundwater thermal exchange device. I should let members know that is not new. There is a definition of a GTAD right now. So it's not a new animal in that sense. It's something the department's already contemplated that would exist. Lines 2.2428, those are some strikeouts. And what you see there in current language is limiting 200 permits to 20 gallons or less and to 10 for 20 to 50. We're not sure what the purpose of that is, but our thought was to not have any caps on the amount of wells that or projects that Darcy could work on. We posted this out to the department last week, and we haven't been in discussions with them, but certainly we will be as we move forward. I don't know where they're at on that, but that was our thinking behind that. As you move into page three, we have some language about construction requirements, 3.7, 3.10, and so forth. I want to highlight 3.19 to 0.21. That has to do with monitoring. Again, we're not trying to have any contamination here. One of the things we wanted to put in the bill was a requirement that these things were monitored for leaks. I'll jump ahead to 3.26 and 2.8. That has to do with clarifying on how it's constructed when it's referencing screens and casings and so forth. Then the final major point here, subdivision 3A and 3.29, is the transfer fluids. That is to spell out and clarify what can and cannot be contained in these devices. You'll see a reference to food grade and NSF 60. Just to clarify that there's no dispute about what can and can't go in there. And then the final section there is consumptive use. What we're trying to say here is that these are not consumptive use devices to go into the DNR permitting process at all. These are neutral in terms of groundwater use. I'll close, members, with a reference to David Henrich. He's also on the call here. He would be able to answer any technical questions you have. And the final thing is I also work for the Minnesota Water Well Association, the trade association. They've had a question on licensing, and they may have others as we move forward. And so we want to make sure we have the right licensing going forward. And I want to acknowledge that to members as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Cleveland. And so that's all I have in terms of testifiers. Are there questions from members? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is kind of new, not something that I'm very much familiar with, but on the other hand, I had heard of geothermal from actually decades ago, people saying that this is something that makes so much sense in Minnesota. And so, yes, it does seem to me to be something really important to make sure that we clear up and facilitate the adoption of this technology. So as a health committee, I guess if we can talk specifically about, you know, about the water itself that we're using for. Does it just come up into the building and go back down again? Or, you know, what is it the water itself or just the temperature and what impact would it have on groundwater?
Representative Long?
I think I'll defer to Mr. Larson for the technical details.
Okay, Mr. Larson.
On mute.
Thank you. Managing technology. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the groundwater actually stays in the ground itself. So it stays within the aquifer and does not come up into the building itself.
So Mr. Larson, just to follow up, could you just explain what the water, okay, it doesn't come into the building. So what is the function of the water? What impact do we have on the water here?
Sure. Yes, the water is the medium that provides the energy exchange. So either heating up or cooling down a fluid that circulates through piping down into the ground through a heat exchanger and back to the building. So that's a closed loop system, but then the groundwater is just passing across that closed loop system using a heat exchanger to either bring it down in temperature or raise it up in temperature, depending on whether we're calling for air conditioning or heating.
Okay, Representative Pryor?
And then just to be clear then, going through this closed loop heat exchange, does it change the temperature of the groundwater?
Mr. Larson.
Yes, it does change it at that point of impact. But then it's very similar to the way a traditional geothermal system would work. That energy does get dissipated throughout the groundwater and the surrounding earth and soil as well, and then returns to its native temperature very, very quickly.
Representative Pryor? Okay. Representative Damoth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Long. The question about the heat transfer fluids, are those fluids included in the bill? Are they the ones that are currently being used right now?
Representative Long, or should I go back to Mr. Larson?
I think Mr. Larson for the technical answer.
All right, Mr. Larson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Those are what we're trying to do is utilize as much language as we can that's already in place. So those fluids are part of the existing code as it relates to geothermal heat exchangers.
Representative Dama?
Nothing further. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Long. I have a question about the scope of this technology. I'm reading the bill. It talks about wells, and I picture my grandma's well, and it's, you know, it's working for one house. But I also have the feeling that it's a much broader scope of applicability to bigger buildings or bigger developments. Can you talk about how it would actually be deployed or is being deployed?
Mr. Larson?
Yes, thank you again, Madam Chair. Yeah, the our first commercial installation is actually at the local 455 Pipefitters Steam Fitters building in St. Paul. And that's a combination warehouse, training facility, and office space, 90,000 square foot building. And it's a great example of the type of project that we can utilize our technology for. And so we envision multifamily residential. We envision commercial applications as well, just like that. So it's a broad swath of the buildings across the state.
Okay, Representative Ryer, anything further on that?
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Long, for bringing this forward. I wanted to just ask a question about monitors. It was mentioned, I think Mr. Larson spoke about the monitoring system, the potential for leaks. And I just wanted to hear from you about the reporting on that monitoring. Who oversees that? Is it the company or is there MPC, Minnesota Pollution Control? Are they involved in it at all? How does that flush out?
Mr. Larson?
Yes, and actually, can I defer that one to Mr. Henrich? I think he is probably technically can give you.
Okay, well, Mr. Henrich, can you introduce yourself, please, for the record and who you work for, and then if you can answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Henrich. I'm the president of Bergeson Caswell Incorporated. And yes, I mean, I believe that the MPCA is the ultimate authority if there is a reportable leak in these systems. I forget what the exact thresholds are, but that kind of language is already contained inside of the MDH well code if we were to have a similar issue with a current more common closed loop board system.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Bierman.
So is the monitoring such that you have to go out to the site to check it, or is there some sort of data collection you get alerting you to a potential leak or an actual leak?
Mr. Henrich?
With today's systems, it would be very easy to monitor this kind of system remotely to see if there was an issue or a potential issue. So the automation that's connected to most of these commercial mechanical systems could very easily detect and alert potential issues as such as a leak in a system.
One more question, please.
Yeah, Representative Bierman.
Just curious about how new is the system? And you mentioned one place that it's been already put out there. Is it in other states already, or how expansive is the use?
Mr. Henrich, is that for you too?
Madam Chair, Mr. and Representative Bierman. This is a fairly new bend. I mean, our company's been installing geothermal systems across the country for over 20 years, almost 30 years now. And so, you know, parts of this concept are very, very tried and true. But the way that Darcy Solutions has melded some new ideas with some existing technology has really brought something very interesting that I haven't seen in my 20 years doing this work. So Minnesota is a homegrown product in the state of Minnesota, and it would be great if we could continue to develop this product in our backyard.
All right, so I have Representative Backer and then Quam, and then I think we're gonna finish up on this bill. Representative Backer.
Actually, I was double booked. I'm letting you know that I am present. That's all I had.
All right, well, glad to have you here. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I was hoping to get some clarification on possible impact of local water table with these open loop systems. If there was a great penetration, as in participation in a like a new neighborhood was put in, and the vast majority of the neighborhood decided to go with this, what would be the impact for the local water table? And then what studies can we review and look at of the possible sources of contamination or shift in substructures in the local region? Thank you.
And Mr. Larson, you could probably tell that Representative Quam is an engineer. So, yes. Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Long, were you also looking to?
Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. Yes, this is an important distinction for our technology. It is a closed loop system. So it is, it gets many of the same sort of heat exchange benefits that an open loop system would without consuming any water. It is considered a non-consumptive use of water. The water actually stays in place in the aquifer. We're putting the heat exchanger down into that aquifer, so we're not seeing any drawdown in the resource itself through the use of our technology. And therefore, the water table is not impacted because we're not making that withdrawal.
Madam Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. Just a clarification, I'm a physicist who has worked as an engineer and a scientist, so some of that crossover. But my understanding my understanding, this bill includes open loop systems, and this is changing the total number of permits. So has the DE, so there is no impact whatsoever on permits or possible quantity of permits for open loop systems?
Mr. Larson, you're nodding your head no.
Correct. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. No, we're all not right. Looking to do anything with open loop systems with our with our legislation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Quam, yeah.
So this increase is only meant to increase permits for your special variation of the closed loop? Because, decades ago, we looked at putting a closed loop geothermal on a high school that was a project that we're looking at building. And so they've been around for a long time, and I'm trying to just understand, this is being predicated by just a special type of closed loop, and it gives special additional permits just for that closed loop. Can the author clarify that, please?
Okay, Representative Long.
Sure, thank you for the question, Representative Quam. So Mr. Clevin put it well with apples and oranges, there is no real permit that fits this technology perfectly. And so they have had to seek variances to be able to move forward with this technology. And that uses staff time at MDH, it uses, create some unpredictability for the developers and for the building owners who want to use this technology. And so we're trying to clarify where this lives within the structure of the current process for receiving a permit.
All right, so Representative Long, the question I have then following on all this is about a couple of the testifiers have said, as this moves forward, different things will be worked out. Our process here is we're going to lay the bill over today. And when we move our finance bill forward, that's kind of the end of the opportunity for a lot of the process. Of course not. It's never over till it's over, as you know. But is there, has there been work with the Department of Health on this? And, where are we in that? Because I think Representative Quam's question kind of about the drafting here, I had sort of a similar question because it's modifying the underlying statute. And is there ongoing work with the department? Can you just fill us in a bit on that?
Sure, happy to, Madam Chair. So we shared, as was mentioned, the language last week for the DE with the department. They thanked us for sending it. They didn't share any concerns back with us. So I'm still happy to continue to have a conversation. I know it's a busy time and there's a lot going on in a lot of committees, but if there are any concerns raised, I think we'd be happy to work through them, but so far I'm not aware of any.
Well, great. Well, thank you very much. And, I think members of this committee, maybe with the possible exception of Representative Quam, we don't have a lot of technical background this is sort of the water quality piece, even though it's under MDH, so it's in our jurisdiction, it's a little bit of our, something we're not as familiar with. So I think many members have a little discomfort kind of being the arbiters of this since we don't really have the background. So if you can get the department to really weigh in and give us their okay or their tweaks or whatever it would take, that would really be very, very helpful for us. So thank you very much for bringing us this interesting bill, Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll do that. I'll follow up with MDH.
That would be great. And with that, House File, let's see, what's our number here? 2108. as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, testifiers. Okay, we're going to move now to House File 2136.
Oh, this is Glenn Grunhagen. This is Glenn Grunhagen.
Okay, we see you, Representative Grunhagen. Okay. Okay, so House File 2136, Representative Richardson is here. Since she's not on the committee, the chair will move House File 2136 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Richardson, you have a DE1 amendment. Did you want to move that now or wait and explain it, or what's your pleasure?
It would be great, Madam Chair, if you could move that amendment now and I can explain it.
Okay, terrific. So the chair moves the DE1 amendment. Should we adopt that before you go ahead and explain the bill as amended?
That would be fine, okay. With you, Madam Chair.
All right. So the chair moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Richardson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 2136 is related to the Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnant Women program, also known as ICHRP. The ICHRP program began as a pilot project to support pregnant women who are on medical assistance and at significant risk of elevated risk of adverse outcomes of pregnancy, including preterm birth, low birth weight babies, maternal opiate addiction, and other substance use disorders. The program has been focused on working to address disparities and low birth weight babies in the Black community, and a focus on maternal opiate use in the state's 5 largest tribal nations, which includes White Earth, Red Lake, Leech Lake, Mille Lacs, and the Fond du Lac Nation. Prematurity, low birth weight, and neonatal abstinence syndrome are the leading causes of costly neonatal intensive care unit admissions, and these adverse birth outcomes are strongly associated with disadvantaged social conditions. The ICHRP integrated team screens for these psychosocial risks and high-risk populations. They then coordinate community-supported interventions along with medical interventions to reduce those risks. The integrated teams have included prenatal care practitioners, behavioral health professionals, public health nurses, substance use disorder treatment facilities, child protection, and tribal nations. This bill would continue the work of the program and appropriate $964,000 in fiscal year 2022 and $629,000 in fiscal year 2023 to continue the initiative for communities that are above average for adverse risk outcomes. Today, I have with me Dr. Nora Hall to testify in support of the bill.
All right, thank you very much. Dr. Hall, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Liebling, and thank you, Health Finance Policy members, for hearing this bill. So I am one of the consultants that works with African-American ICHRP, and I thought I would just provide just a little bit of background. Representative Richardson has done a phenomenal job talking about what we've done, but I'll just provide a little bit of information there and leave any questions that you might have, leave time for questions you might have. So I'd like to just kind of say that ICHRP, we've been working with the ICHRP African American group, but there has certainly been indigenous work as Representative Richardson has noted. And it's a community driven initiative. And I will say that it's been community driven from the beginning. So DHS has done a fantastic job of making sure that the community is in charge and making decisions in terms of design and how services are provided and all of that throughout the whole process. So that's really admirable. You might know just a little bit about the African American program, but I just want to give you a sense that if you don't know, Black women are 2 to 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes and white women. So Minnesota kind of leads the nation in disparities for Indigenous and African-American women. And of course, none of us like that. So this program is one of those efforts to really try to address that. And so in 2017, following a 2015 legislative directive from DHS, to DHS from the legislature to implement this pilot program, the African-American
iChirp began. And so we have services in Hennepin and Ramsey County. And the folks who provide the services in Hennepin County are North Point iChirp. And we have in Ramsey County, Open Cities and Minnesota Community Care. They provide direct services, but they have been doing quite a lot of work through social media as well as, and certainly in the last year or so, but before that, they were also doing outreach through social media, but they have peer support groups as well, and also one-on-one kinds of activities. We also have AABC and Projects, which provides outreach to communities to let them know about this effort and to healthcare providers, because it's important for healthcare providers to know about this as well as the community at large so that they can refer people to the work. So as I mentioned, it started in 2017, and in 2017 and 2018, the three grantee organizations served about 4,500 families. This is through the direct services they provide, and particularly also through social media activities, and probably and through the outreach work, more than 30,000 or so folks were reached through radio shows and through social media and training and activities that happen for healthcare professionals as well. In 2019 and 2020, the three grantees served probably around 7,000 families. And I do want to emphasize that when we say families, we're not just talking about mothers and children. We are definitely talking about fathers, mothers, and children. And they probably reached, in terms of social media campaigns in 2019-20, probably around 5,000 or more folks. And so the African-American iChirp service model is a community-led model. So that's kind of a really important factor for us to make sure that it's community-driven. It focuses on early prenatal identification of families with elevated psychosocial risks. So we're trying to find ways to reduce those risks that impact birth outcomes, as the research has shown. And the integrated team, as Representative Richardson had mentioned, have quite a lot of paraprofessionals who are involved in that process to really kind of deal with many of those social determinants of health factors that we think about, like food insecurity and also homelessness, which we might have families who may not have places to live during this time. So we are here, you know, because we really want to expand iChirp and to reach more families. And we're hoping that this bill will help us to get to that place that we'd like to get to. So I'll stop there and answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Hall. Are there any questions from members? Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill forward. I particularly am relieved and feel confident when I hear that programs are community-driven. I think it's the only way for programs to be successful. My question is, looking at the appropriation amounts, I was just wondering about the reason for the lower amount in fiscal year 2023 compared to 2022.
Representative Richardson, or should we go to Ms. Hall, to Dr. Hall?
Madam Chair, if you could go to Dr. Hall, that would be great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Hall.
It would probably be more appropriate for someone from VHS to answer this. I can give you a sense of my understanding of it, but I know Ellie Garrett is on this call, and perhaps she might want to step in. But we've been,
okay.
Yeah, so perhaps maybe we should call on her so you don't get any misinformation from
her. All right, and let me just then ask this preliminary question. I know that this is in the governor's budget, and is the proposal today the same as what's in the governor's budget? It is. Okay, great. All right, thanks. That helps. Okay, Ms. Garrett?
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Dr. Hall and the rest of the committee. My name is Ellie Garrett. I work at the Department of Human Services, where I manage a team called Population Health Innovations. And the iChirp work resides in the team that I manage. And we collaborate very, very closely with the Medicaid medical director, Dr. Nathan Schomelo, and others in the healthcare administration on this work. Just to clarify about the numbers, after reviewing the amendment, I think the amendment may need to be tweaked just a little bit, because I believe our intent was that this would be for the same amount that was in the bill, in the governor's budget. And what's reflected there now is the net amount that's in the change page rather than the total appropriation. So I know our legislative staff and team were going to reach out to the finance committee's team and clarify that. The reason for the savings over time is that the literature shows, and our anecdotal experience from the pilot shows, that as this program grows, we can expect that more and more babies will be born healthier. And quite frankly, that, of course, the most important thing that we achieve with healthier babies is healthier babies and healthier families. But there is also a very rapid impact on the state's budget, because as we are as the program is able to help limit the number of babies that need to have extended stays and in an intensive care unit, for example, the program will rapidly pay for itself. So we have some front-end costs that are associated with investing in this expansion, but the savings will fairly quickly accrue and even be seen in the next two biennia. And that's savings just in the smaller part of our Medicaid budget where fee-for-service resides. Most births are actually paid for through our managed care budget. And because of the way managed care is reimbursed, it takes a little longer for us to accrue those savings because we have to show the reduced costs, and then there's actuerial work. We expect the savings in future biennia would theoretically end up paying for this, but we are only claiming the amount that we will show in the smaller part of the budget, which is fee for service.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Garrett. And then Representative Ryer, I think that was your question, wasn't it? Do you have a follow-up?
Oh, it was my question. Thank you. So my concern had been that this reflected an expectation of a reduced level of service and a reduced number of families that were served, but I'm hearing that that's not an accurate interpretation. Is that right?
Ms. Garrett?
Chair Liebling, Representative Breyer, you're correct. We will be working with the Finance Committee staff to clarify the amount, and then the savings we expect to increase, so net expenses to the state will decrease over time, but services will actually increase over time as more and more of the expenses are able to be absorbed within the Medicaid budget and leaving the grant funds to be available for the community-based work that cannot be paid for directly through the Medicaid budget.
Okay, Representative Breyer.
If I may have one more follow-up.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Thank you. My question is for Dr. Hall, I think, and thank you for your earlier testimony. My question is always, when we're looking at something like this that gets at the root cause of a problem and helps us have so much savings, what is the actual capacity and what is the actual need if we were to say we had a magic budget wand and we could go bigger and broader? What might that look like? Because I'm just trying to understand if we're scratching the surface or really putting a nice dent in it.
The numbers, Hall. Yeah, I think, thank you for the question. The numbers are I think Minnesota has around a little bit less than 70,000 births a year, somewhere around that number, and about 11% of those, or 7,600 of those, are African American. So that's like looking at the state as a whole. I don't have those numbers for the Ramsey and Hennepin counties where we're working, but ultimately, I think if this program is to be successful for the state, it really should grow to scale beyond just Hennepin and Ramsey County. So yeah, we're not serving anywhere near those numbers in terms of one-on-one family connections because of the number of peer support groups that the iChirp groups are able to provide, the organization they will provide. We get the numbers often because we're doing outreach on social media. People are tuning in for information, but I think they can serve more people. The other factor is they'll need additional staff for that. So currently the funds that are in the budget do really not, they aren't there to have the kind of staffing that's necessary. We've been doing quite a lot of connecting with health organizations in the state who are very eager to work with us. And of course, that's their question too. How much capacity can you handle? And right now we can't say, well, send us everything you have, because we could not handle that. But we are trying to set up a pilot project to get a sense of what referrals might look like. And yeah, and so we need to really, I guess, staff up to really accommodate more people.
All right, thank you, Dr. Holland. I just have a real quick question to kind of finish up here. It kind of comes off of Representative Ryer's question too. Is there any kind of data collection that's built in here so that, I mean, one of the, I think you might have said, or somebody else said, that one of the things about when you, of course, work with trying to improve maternal and child health outcomes, you see the results pretty quickly. And so it's always exciting if we can gather data and be able to really show the results. And you're nodding. Is that something that you're going to, that's built in here?
Yeah, that is actually absolutely something that's built into scaling up. It is currently not in the current grants that are received. So we have encouraged our population, and the consultants have done some work in this area to gather some numbers. This is why I could share some with you when I did my opening comments. But yes, indeed, we should definitely track those kinds of activities. And we do hear regular reports on healthy births, that people are working with women who are having healthy births. So those are really positive at this point. But yes, we need funds for that.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Representative Richardson. With that, House File 2136, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And thank you, testifiers. Thank you, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, next bill on our agenda is House File 2129, which is my bill. And I'm just going to explain to members, this bill is here as a vehicle bill. So if you're inclined to try to figure out what it really does or what it's about, it kind of doesn't matter that much. And just to explain for members who are new, this is just for the legislative process. The intention is here that the chairs of committees in the House and Senate have vehicle bills that are matched up bills, so that if need be, we can have a way to quickly, if we agree on a bill, for example, we can move it through the process a little more quickly and have these bills kind of park there that can be amended with whatever the decision is. So Senator Benson and I are trying to have a few of these bills that are matched bills that will still be doing the same thing in the Senate. So there's the content of them is not so important. Sometimes people do this, they don't exactly explain that, but I think it just makes it simpler just so everybody knows what's going on here. It's not a secret. And so we would be moving this bill out. We're going to vote on the bill so that we can move it to Ways and Means. So the motion here is that House File 2129 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And so again, the intention is that's where it'll stay unless we need it. Sometimes we don't need them, but so any questions about that? I'm not seeing any. Mr. Berg, did you want to say anything about it? I see there is a question from Representative Keel, but Mr. Berg, did you want to comment? This is a
a bill that looks like it would just want a brief explanation of what the forecast article is and why this is a technical, I can do that.
Well, I don't know if that's necessary, Mr. Berg. Let's see what Representative Keel's question is. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I am asking anything is just clarifying. If it goes to Ways and Means and sits there and then ends up being a vehicle bill, will we come back to committee and hear what is in that bill? I'm kind of asking for the general reader. How does it work?
Well, Representative Keel, usually it's a little hard to say at this point because it kind of depends on what it is, but usually it's legislation that's gone through and it just gets put on that vehicle for purposes of matching it up with the Senate's bill. So the legislation itself would not be written or, you know, be for the first time in Ways and Means. I think that's kind of what you're getting at. That's just not kind of how it works. So it's not an attempt to pull anything over in anyone or skip committees. It's just, you know, what you usually do is have some vehicles in different stages of the process just to facilitate if we need to be able to get it through in time, just for procedurally. Because as you know, when we pass a bill out of our committee, it has to go to the floor and then it has to get re-referred. And so this is just kind of a common practice that's been done ever since I've been in the legislature by members on both sides. Representative Munson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted people to understand the detail.
Thank you, Representative Keel. We're having a little trouble hearing you. Your connection isn't so good, but I think we got the meaning there. Representative Munson.
And Madam Chair, I guess, you know, I've been talking to constituents about what vehicle bills are, and I think that the general consensus is it's kind of a vehicle to circumvent the requirement of our Constitution that requires thorough vetting and public input on bills. But this is not something that could be worked out with a conference committee between the House and Senate. Should the language be different? Is that we're going to be passing this bill on and assuming that there will be health language attached to this bill that may or may not have been vetted in this committee. Is that right?
Well, Representative Munson, I don't think that's the way this would happen. It would be just a matter of needing to move. Say, for example, we moved a bill to the floor and it didn't pass the floor. And then we needed to come back and there was a tweak to it that everybody agreed to. And then we need to bring it back and, you know, it doesn't circumvent scrutiny by anybody. And just to be clear, this only works if the Senate agrees as well. So this is just a way to be quicker if you need to, but often we don't even end up using them, frankly. It's just kind of as a, you know, should we need to, you know, usually that's how it works. You know, there's an agreement. You know, everybody says, okay, we've got the final deal. And it doesn't mean we wouldn't hear it in this committee. Because if there's anything new that needs to be vetted, we're going to hear it here. Ways and Means isn't even set up for that. Ways and Means doesn't even take testimony. So we're not skipping the process in that respect.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and then other questions on that? And would anyone like the explanation from Mr. Berg about what the underlying bill actually is? Okay, not seeing any takers on that one. So, okay, with that then, Ms. Niedernhofer, if you could take the roll, I will renew my motion that House File 2129 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And the chair votes aye.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer votes aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grinhagen.
Aye.
Grinhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott. Representative Wolgamott. There are 17 ayes and one nay.
All right. There being 17 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails and the bill is passed to Ways and Means. Thank you. Thank you for your confidence, members. Okay, we are on now to House File 785, Representative Freiberg's bill. And so Representative Freiberg's motion would be to move House File 785, the first engrossment, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I will make that motion. And I also would like to move the A2 amendment.
Okay. Representative Freiberg moves the A2 amendment. Did you want to discuss the amendment before you adopt it, or do you want to adopt and then discuss?
Sure, I can adopt it. It would put the bill in the shape I would like. It reflects technical assistance from DHS. The amendment will clarify how acupuncture is covered in the managed care benefit versus the fee-for-service benefit. The medical assistance statutes referenced in the amendment already contain a coverage for acupuncture services.
All right, so let's take a vote then on adopting the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Freiberg, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep my comments fairly brief. I know there are a few people here to testify, but House File 785 is bipartisan legislation that would require health plans to cover acupuncture for the treatment of pain and pain management when performed by an authorized acupuncture practitioner. In light of the opioid epidemic, we need to encourage non-opioid pain management options, and acupuncture is one important option. I have testifiers here who will speak to the evidence that supports acupuncture as a pain management tool. Many insurance companies do cover acupuncture, but the coverage is inconsistent. It is important to have a baseline of coverage in place so that patients can access this potentially life-saving medicine. I've been having discussions with the health plans regarding the bill, and the limitation on the number of visits is an attempt to address some of their concerns. With that, I can turn it over to the testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. So let's see. We have first on our list as a testifier is Dr. Amy Major.
Major. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for this opportunity to talk about acupuncture, right? An evidence-based non-opioid treatment for pain, which was, I work with the American Society of Acupuncturists, and I am vice chair of public policy. I'm also the chair of legislation in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for the Acupuncture Society of Massachusetts. The Joint Commission for Public Health asked for all insurances to cover acupuncture as a non-opioid evidence-based treatment for pain in 2017 for 2018. We are still working on this. 37 attorneys general wrote to the American Health Insurance Plan Institute asking for this coverage. It has not happened yet. The Minnesota Acupuncture Association and the ASA is grateful to Representative Freiberg for his support to make this happen in Minnesota. What happens when patients have the opportunity, when medically necessary, to use acupuncture as part of their evidence-based non-opioid treatment for pain? the number of opioids is decreased that is in the flow, number one. Number two, patients have fewer visits to the ER because when their pain is well managed, they don't have to go to the ER, which is much more cost prohibitive and will cost every insurance company more. Patients have a higher quality of life and are able to increase their activities of daily living, right? And more fully participate in those with less pain without being medicated, right? So all of these things are things that we're asking your permission to provide to patients. On our part, what does that mean? That means more paperwork, less payment for treatment, but it means access for patients to meaningful evidence-based non-pharmacological treatments for pain. I will be citing research in my written testimony, which will be to you within the next 24 hours, which includes the Tick and Nielsen paper. It also includes the National Governors Association white paper on evidence-based treatments in lieu of opioids, and acupuncture is one of the top three treatments consistently. So we are asking for your support to move this bill, right, HF 785, so that patients in Minnesota have access to their choice of evidence-based non-opioid treatments for pain. And I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Major. Next, we have Bonnie Bolash. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Bolash. I'm a Minnesota licensed acupuncturist. I'd like to thank you for allowing this hearing on the issue of acupuncture coverage. I have sent each of you an email asking for your support with many of the reasons you should support this legislation. Many insurance companies currently cover acupuncture, including the recent addition of Medicare in January 2020. This bill will require Minnesota insurance companies to cover acupuncture for pain and ongoing pain management. Part of this bill addresses visit limits in response to concerns brought from the insurance industry. The 30 visit limits were taken from Blue Cross Blue Shield's chiropractic visit limit and is similar to 15 states' limits on physical therapy and occupational therapy and 7 states' limits on chiropractic. In Minnesota, the essential health benefits coverage for chiropractic, physical therapy, and occupational therapy are unlimited visits unless you go to an out-of-network provider, and that limits the visits to 20. We, as licensed acupuncturists, are asking to be treated as similarly situated professionals. This increases access for patients to their choice of evidence-based non-opioid treatments for pain and ongoing pain management. The opioid epidemic was really a wake-up call to all of us on how are we addressing and managing pain. This epidemic also brings attention to the fact that certain populations may need access to non-pharmacological pain management because pain medications put them at greater risk for harm. We need a cultural shift in how we view and treat pain, including the coverage of biophysical treatments like acupuncture and making sure that pain treatments are not denied to those in need. I'm asking for your support of House File 785. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bolash. Appreciate it. Dr. Chuck Sawyer, welcome. Oh, we can't hear you.
He's muted.
No. There, maybe. No, Dr. Sawyer, we're not. Your sound is not working, apparently. No, we're not hearing you. Well, maybe what we can do is go to member questions. And Dr. Sawyer, maybe you can work on, I don't know what the problem would be there, but it looks unmuted, but it isn't. So sorry about that. Okay, are there member questions? All right, I'm not really, okay, there we have one. Representative Bierman. And we can't hear you either. There we go.
I haven't spoken yet. Sorry okay. about that. I wasn't quite ready to get unmuted. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Freiberg, for bringing the bill forward. I do have a question. You had mentioned early in your presentation that the coverage is not uniform across insurers. And I'm just wondering if there is a uniformity on the conditions for which acceptance of acupuncture is an accepted treatment that is any way uniform among companies.
Representative Freiberg.
Among companies, that I don't know. The coverage is inconsistent. I mean, there's a lot of data showing that acupuncture is an effective method for treating pain, and that's what this bill is attempting to get at. But perhaps one of my testifiers can more directly answer your question.
Dr. Major, do you want to take that?
Sure. So it depends on the plan, at least in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I'm not familiar with all of the plans in Minnesota, but let's look at the VA. The VA covers for the treatment of pain in all 50 states. It doesn't matter where the pain is, but the VA covers. The VA has a different system of SEOCs, of episodes of care that require specific documentation. Others require different documentation. It all depends on how the insurance plan is written by that specific company. Traditionally, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, pain, PTSD, nausea, and opiate addiction are covered by most plans. But it depends on how the insurer chooses to write the plan for the treatment of pain. And we don't know, you know, if you're asking for where the evidence is, the Tick and Nielsen paper, which I'll be including in my written testimony, has significant evidence about what where, what types of pain acupuncture is used for. But the work of Vitaly Napadau, who's a PhD licensed acupuncturist, researcher, and instructor at Harvard Medical School, speaks very clearly to the fact that in real time under fMRI, his research demonstrates that you put an acupuncture needle in and it changes the brain chemistry of the patient receiving the acupuncture. So it shifts perception of pain and shifts pain also by addressing connective tissue. We know this from the work of Helene Langevin, who's an MD licensed acupuncturist, researcher, and chair of NCCIH. I hope that's answered.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to see Dr. Sawyer. You want to give it a try again? No, we're still not hearing you. So sorry about that. Technology, when it works, it's great, and sometimes it isn't great. Okay. So I've been told here that maybe DHS would have a comment on this. Is there someone here from DHS who could? I think maybe an answer to Representative Bierman's question about different. Oh, there we go. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the DOA, Department of Human Services. Unfortunately, we don't have an answer to this question. The bill is written out to apply to Medicaid for Minnesota care, and we just don't have a sense of what other commercial market insurers are covering as far as acupuncture goes.
All right. Can you actually, since we have you here, the bill is right now excluding managed care, but we do cover this under fee-for-service. Is that the situation?
Madam Chair, slight clarification there. The bill is not putting the requirement in Chapter 62 that it applies to Medicaid or Minnesota care. However, the legislature has already passed law that in 260-0625 that says that medical assistance and Minnesota care, whether administered by fee-for-service or managed care or admission, does cover acupuncture services. So as Representative Feinberg mentioned at the outset of his comments, acupuncture is already a covered service in Medicaid and Minnesota care, whether it's fee-for-service or managed care.
Okay. And then, Mr. Hayes, is there a limit on the number of visits then under the public programs?
Madam Chair, the statute does not specify a limit, and so via policy, the managed care organizations and the fee-for-service program are able to use utilization management as far as acupuncture services go.
Okay, because the bill is as written, you know, says that there must be 30 visits before prior authorization can be used. So that sounds like it might be a little more expansive than what we currently do under public programs if this was applying to public programs, correct?
Madam Chair, that is more expansive than what currently is covered in the fee-for-service program, correct?
Okay. Okay. Can anyone, let's see, Representative Munson has a question. Let's go to Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Freiberg, for bringing this forward. I did sign on as a co-author, and I'm a supporter of acupuncture, having been raised by a long line of chiropractors and under Eastern medicine as a child. So I support it as an option for pain patients. Maybe the Department of Health or perhaps Mr. Berg weigh in, when this was authorized for public health care, did it increase the costs? Was there a significant increase in cost in covering this, or was it offset by reduction in opiates and perhaps addiction services as a result? Can anybody weigh in if there's been any analysis on that?
Right. Mr. Hayes, can you answer that?
Madam Chair and members, currently in the fee-for-service program, we spend about $100,000 a year on acupuncture. So, I mean, there was a fiscal note when the bill passed several years ago, and today the spend is only about $100,000.
And Representative Munson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I was wondering if, acupuncturist from Massachusetts, if there was any...
Dr. Major,
Dr. Major, if there was any knowledge you had of the fiscal impact of this in Massachusetts when it was rolled out for private plans?
That's an excellent question. Major. Thank you, Representative Munson, for asking it. So, Commonwealth Care is one of the Medicaid plans in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and they have found that there's been a significant decrease in ER visits and in specialist visits, specifically to neurologists and orthopedists, after they have seen the patient, evaluated the patient, that they end up receiving care from their licensed acupuncturist who is managing their pain. So there are fewer ER visits, and that has decreased costs. And that is why Commonwealth Care was the first plan to proactively ask for acupuncture to be covered.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Dr. Sawyer, do you want to give it one more try? No, I'm afraid not.
Maybe if he call his headphones.
Okay, well. All right. Well, so, okay. Are there any other questions for members? All right. You know, I just to represent Munson's point, you know, one of the, of course, unfortunate things about the way we do our fiscal process in the legislature is that oftentimes we're unable to count savings down the road from a change in policy. And that makes things show up as a cost that perhaps shouldn't. And it's very hard for us to evaluate that. That might be changing a little bit, but usually you have to have something very well studied and documented. And I'm frankly not exactly sure what it takes before something, the savings get counted, you know, reduced ER visits, reduced opioid use, whatever it might be, gets actually baked into the fiscal analysis so that it comes out of savings instead of a cost, or at least a lower cost. So I don't know, that's something to be talking with DHS about, I guess. And it could be the fiscal note that if this policy passed just a few years ago, that fiscal note should still be available. So, but I doubt very much that it accounts for savings, because that's just not, generally speaking, how it's done. So Representative Freiberg, I think we've reached the end here. If you want to have a final word, and then we could lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is an important bill to help address the opioid crisis. Glad to be carrying it, and I appreciate that the committee has given this bill some consideration. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Freiberg and testifiers. So with that, the chair will lay over House File 785, the first engrossment as amended, for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So with that, we are finishing up a little bit ahead of schedule today, and tomorrow we're going to be hearing some presentations of issues that are in the governor's budget, although we don't actually have the revised budget yet, but we're going to get a little jump on that just so that we can start to hear about some of the proposals that are in there so we can be a little bit more informed when we do actually get the bill. So with that, members, we are adjourned.